Greetings, podcast listeners, and welcome to the March edition of the Colorado Review podcast. My name's Daniel Schoening.
And I'm Evan Senny.
Joining us today is Adam Fagan, author of the recent collection Furthest Ecology and a selection from the Mountain West Poetry Series. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you very much.
Today we're going to talk about Adam's first collection, his experiences teaching, and his creative process.
So let's get right into it with a discussion of Furthest Ecology. In terms of the work at hand, there's such spareness. There's a real attention to the innate power and depth of each individual word in its placement on the page, in the constellation of those words and how they push and pull against each other. I was wondering if this was always a style and a form of writing that you tended towards, or if this is something that you've moved into as you've moved further in your poetry career.
Yeah, I think I've always been a minimalist, you know, always working through revision to cut away until I have the essence of something that I'm really comfortable with and I really love, you know. And so I have, I think, a lot of strategies in this book, you know, a lot of formal strategies for achieving that. Sometimes there are only a few words grouped together on a page. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm thinking about movement, you know, on the page, visual movement, because the layout is obviously very important. Sometimes I'm thinking more about the music, but also thinking about how those things go together at any given moment. And so I thought of really, in this book, each page is a canvas, you know, mm-hmm. A kind of musical moving canvas that I could play with and think about ideas before moving on to the next chapter of the narrative I was trying to write. Mm-hmm.
This piece largely revolves around Abbott Thayer, and I was wondering if you could speak a bit to where that interest began in him as a figure and how he figures in this book.
Well, I first became aware of Abbott Thayer. I was in MFA school, and I was a teaching assistant for a curator at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and he was doing an exhibition about Abbott Thayer, and he mentioned him to me. And right away, I don't know, I think poets or artists or writers, there's sort of this intuitive pull towards certain topics, you know, and I just heard what he had done, you know, being thought of as the father of camouflage. And I was just so curious, I felt called to it, and I started to explore it right away. And that was sort of the genesis. You know, I didn't know that I would sort of get into, you know, very deep into parts of his life and think about their relation to my own. But that was the process. That was the beginning of the process.
Was that process planned, or did you sort of see where it led you? Because my understanding of the book is that we get from a place that's sort of lighter to one that's much darker and more in depth. Is that just reflective of the exploration that you did?
Yes. I really didn't have a sense of the narrative arc that the book takes, you know, sort of thinking first about his ideas, moving into, you know, certain issues that he had, and then moving into his kind of dissolution or his unraveling. Mm-hmm. I did not think about that right away. You know, it was a process of learning about his life. And writing everything I could. And, you know, I was really experimenting with form and ideas in this. And it was only much later, you know, when I was putting together my thesis in my MFA program, that I could clearly see, with some help from my advisors, the narrative arc and really put that together in the way that you see it in the final product.
There's so much in this book, especially in reference to Thayer, that feels like it's at once a response to, an encapsulating of. It's trying to represent and be an analog for some aspects of his life and his own movements. But also it feels in some parts like it's an extension of, like a logical expansion of those things that are on hand for him. I was wondering about if there were moments in making it and in exploring Thayer's own past that you felt you had to kick against, had to push away from, support that you had to lean into or use your own reasoning to kind of extrapolate things that might not have been present in record of him?
Yeah, well, I think I had, you know, first of all, a complicated relationship with Abbott Thayer. There was something about what he'd done to project his ideas about camouflage out into the world as an artist that I found really admirable and I really loved, you know, because lots of writers, you know, we want to project ourselves. We want people to think about our ideas. We want them to accept them. But I also had a real disdain for him because, you know, he was really trying to control people and really had this kind of messianic zeal that I had a lot of trouble with and that I wanted to critique. So I think those tensions, I wanted them to be alive in the writing. And so, yeah, I did want to start with his ideas, but in a way I wanted to critique them as well and to show not only the creative power of art, but also the destructive power. Tensions like that that are together in the kind of work that he did and I think the kind of work that we all do as writers.
And somewhere within that tension, I also feel that representative quality that your work undertakes in order to better access or better employ those base concepts that Thayer pursues, especially in reference to camouflage, that on some level, the poems themselves enact those structures of nature that they are also responding to.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fair amount of trying to enact those ideas visually from him, and maybe I'm thinking about showing the destructive power of them, you know, the way that language and art sort of reveals and conceals at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's very much a tension I wanted to get to there.
I was wondering if you would be willing to choose a poem or a few poems that in your mind, enact or engage that question that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I'll read T's Law.
Perfect.
I think that has a, you know, that's towards the beginning when I'm just thinking about working those ideas out in language, especially the ones that we talked about concealing and revealing at the same time. Mm-hmm. T's Law. If among the waxwings flight, I describe unbroken light, I describe water among the sleep of birds. A wing beat governing swift fluidities of form. Dear precious, dear dearest, here I seize on a sea a pure white vessel's breaking. Over many days mistaken for a cloud, a man's eye creeps up the branches, eats the gray buds. He thinks of white as his sun at night. Has he ever thought his impressions are born? Pouring his confinement through a moon's milk stare, first daylight drains this strange bird, attention, residing in a nexus of recurrence. Old ideas that cause the mind to live among bright objects, but only as a means of concealment. Each glance is a distance I simulate. When I require a political economy, I look directly at the sun. Suck through September's pulse, a solar hinge no hand can touch. Sound ascends daylight. The eye is made aware. The boundary is birdsong filled with ghostly listening. Or the color of the sea approaching the clairvoyance of the artist's attention. Weaving his periscope from the dark of inquiry, it is made vessel by faintly visible seashore. A painter is the world, conscious that light belongs there. Reductio ad absurdum. Until a parallel ear forgets, a duplicate canvas engulfs silhouette with particle fire. Here a moment of sculpture tears off its crisscross veil. Monadnock, my mountain home. These rocks are thresholds that multiply praxiteles. Where dewdrops further elucidate the majority of tulips, root outweighs flowerhead, twilight, Prometheus, Sphinx. In the absolute detail it descends, a leaf's inverted vernacular. Out of which one ruptured katydid proceeds, eternally convex, transverse, beneath a breath of moonshine and meadow grass, a shadow's arrowy vehemence.
Just wonderful. one of the things that's operating here that also is a question that I think is worth applying to the work generally is, as you said, that concept of concealing and revealing. And I think it sometimes articulates itself on the level of syntax. Those moments in which we're given full sentences that feel as much in tune to thinking through and maybe logically, typically, discursively thinking through a concept feel at once at odds with those other moments in which we are given the sparest possible reproduction of or incisive view of a concept, but also complementary to them, like a different doorway to the same subject. How did you arrive at those different tools?
Well, you know, I think it was through experimentation, you know. I think maybe what you're sort of suggesting here is a kind of paradox, you know. Mm-hmm. There are lots of contradictions in the text, not just sort of logically, but, you know, syntactically. I think there's a minimalism, but also a lushness to the language, mm-hmm. you know, and that's very important. And also I think, you know, I want the same sort of paradox that maybe somebody like Emily Dickinson has, where, you know, you're allowed to read syntactically in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. You can approach the poem one way and then find a new connection on a different reading and think of where it might go. Or, you know, again, those ways in which language is sort of revealing and concealing or giving multiple pathways at the same time. Mm-hmm.
Given that the finished work is so rich and complex, I was wondering if you could also speak to the process of revision, of rewriting, of making a single piece of art over time, and whether that involved editors and other eyes to contribute to that making, or other influences like Emily Dickinson, as you just offered.
Yeah, well, you know, first off, you know, I have my poetic influences, chief among them, someone like Susan Howe, without whom this couldn't have been written. Mm-hmm. But there were many eyes on it. You know, many people who made very useful suggestions, you know, in my MFA program. You know, it was really one of my great teachers there, Kevin Killian, who really, I think, first identified for me the narrative arc and where it could go and how it could be structured. You know, and I worked very closely with another poet there, Denise Newman. And, you know, she was really instrumental in challenging me, you know, and when I would write drafts to say, well, I don't think you've really attained that level that you need. And letting me sort of work harder and harder and realize what it was that I needed to do. You know, and then aside from that, just a lot of friends making comments, you know, and looking at the book and making changes that were really crucial. And I think, again, they respected the minimalism and what needed to be pared away. You know, when you write a work like this, you're kind of adding, and then you need to cut away. And it was really people identifying, oh, you really don't need, you know, this prose section because we already know it from the poetry. You know, and when you're in the middle of something, you don't necessarily see that.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to take a brief moment to talk about the many other things going on at the Center for Literary Publishing.
As ever at Colorado Review and the Center for Literary Publishing, there is lots to read, listen to, and see in addition to this podcast. Adam Fagan's Luminous Collection is forthcoming through the Mountain West Poetry Series entitled Furthest Ecology, which you can pre-order from the University Press of Colorado at upcolorado.com. Gillian Cummings's book, The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter, is the winner of the 2018 Colorado Prize for Poetry and is available now at coloradoreview.colostate.edu under the tab marked Bookstore. While you're there, you can pick up a copy of our Fall-Winter 2018 edition of Colorado Review, featuring poetry by Benjamin Nakahisebe Kingsley, fiction by Michelle Ross, creative nonfiction by Erica Berry, and many more. Finally, those of you attending AWP can find us March 28th to the 30th in Portland at the Oregon Convention Center, booth number 6068. Evan and I will be manning the booth along with lots of us lucky enough to work here at CLP. Be sure to come by and say hi.
Since this was a project that has spanned many years, I was wondering if you could talk about how your process has changed and how the writing itself has changed.
That's a good question. You know, yeah, I started this book in 2010 when I was in my MFA program. And I don't know if the quality of the writing has changed, but maybe the scope and the focus of it has changed. You know, again, this is a book with a heavy narrative element, even though it's nonlinear, even though it does a lot of things besides that. But yeah, it took a lot of time. It was really time spent doing that, thinking of the focus, thinking about what to leave in, what to take out, how to put together a book like this, right? It could have been a very different book where it didn't have this kind of narrative. You know, it could have been a book where, I sort of tried to make certain parallels with contemporary life in a different way. You know, I feel like there are sort of thoughts about how we think about place, how we think of ourselves in those places, how we interact with the natural world, that are very much things we can think about now. Setting up that took a lot of time and thought and maturation as a writer. Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people listening, I'm sure, that are in the midst of writing poems, writing chapbooks, full-length manuscripts that they are hoping to shop, they're hoping to send around. In your experience of having written a few longer pieces now and potentially working on one to come next, what advice do you have for those listening?
Well, I would just say to write the work that you need to write and don't think about trends. Mm-hmm. You know, to do that is to force the work and to turn it into a product. And I know it's very easy to do, and you can even do it unconsciously. But you really need to find out what's central to your existence and try to collapse the space between your writing and your life. And so, first of all, I would say that. But in terms of getting it published, you know, I would just say, where are the places that really fit? Where are the places mm-hmm. where your work or work that you really love exists? You know, find those places and go towards them, because that's really where it will find a home. You know, don't try to force it into some contest or some publisher that you just think is great because maybe it's prestigious or it's bigger. Mm-hmm. You know, where is the work's home, really? Where is the work that speaks to you, and where do you want it to live?
I was wondering if you could speak to the way that your philosophy about what poetry can do in the world influences your teaching.
Well, you know, I think when I have students, whether they're writers or not, whether they want to be writers or not, I just want to increase their awareness of the power of language, which is something that it's so easy to overlook, how we're bombarded with language that essentially seeks to control our thoughts. You know, just even going back to Abbot Thayer for a second, you know, his fury to convert people to his way of seeing things was something that he had to try to accomplish with words, you know? And so a lot of the works that I do now that I'm teaching, you know, they straddle genre. I might look at, like I have recently this past month with my students, Claudia Rankine's Don't Let Me Be Lonely and Citizen. Mm-hmm. Soon we'll be looking at Mark Nowak's Coal Mountain Elementary, which is about coal mining disasters in West Virginia and in China. And we're really just thinking about the language and how stories get out there and how we're often controlled by certain meta-narratives, you know? So it's really a process of, I really want the students to be able to identify their own narratives and those larger meta-narratives and think about how to push back against those, you know? So I think of it as, in some way, a form of empowerment, you know, if they so choose to accept the responsibility that comes with making work, making language, making art, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Claudia Rankine's Citizen. I think in reading this book and in experiencing the multimedia work that's also at play here, the primary document use, the use of photographs of primary sources of Abbot Thayer's, mm-hmm. There's also a almost lyric essay logic at play in which those things are speaking kind of concurrent to in the same direction of the poetry and the lyric. I wonder about where that places you in your mind as a modern poet, if you are in the scheme of Susan Howe's primary document use, or if you feel that you are employing that mechanism differently, or what the texture of that mechanism is for you.
I don't know if I'm employing it differently, but I'm very aware of how they use image and text to speak to each other. Mm. And yeah, that's something I want to, rather than tell the reader how to accept Abbott Thayer, to give possibilities of thinking, right? Mm. And that's something that I think Rankin does. It's definitely something Howe does. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always thinking about how prose can resonate with the poetry in interesting ways and with the images, you know? Thinking, you know, in this work, I take images, I crop them, I take little parts, I draw your attention to certain places and certain phrases, or I try to draw your attention to indecipherability, mm-hmm. you know, sort of going back on larger ideas about language. So yeah, I'm always thinking about those tensions and those opportunities. And I do think of myself as, yeah, somebody who wants to explore the lyric essay in ways much like Rankin and Howe, for sure.
Mm. Now that this book is out, are there any other projects that you're working on?
Yeah, well, the project that I've been working on for the past few years, and hopefully I'm finished or near finished, is a book about a 19th century Jewish agricultural colony in Cotopaxi, Colorado. And, you know, I really wanted to, like I mentioned before, to collapse that distance between my life and my writing with the lyric essay, because I think it offers certain possibilities of thinking that straightforward narrative doesn't. And so in this project, in the Cotopaxi project, you know, I'm thinking about my Jewish identity. I'm thinking about, or I'm using also in that project, you know, the writing of the work itself. So it becomes a kind of meta-narrative. I think about representation, race, you know, it's an opportunity to think about all those things. And I think what the lyric essay allows you to do is to radically compress the language like poetry. So to write poetry, to create new resonances, but also to allow you to sort of turn on a dime, right? Because you can use a logic that's not just linear. You can use a logic that's associative like poetry. Mm-hmm. And so you can juxtapose things and make new connections that would take a lot longer to do if you were writing linear narrative. And so those possibilities are what animate the project for me.
I had the pleasure of typesetting this wonderful book, and one of the joys of it is to have to place yourself in the mind of the poet, of the writer that first conceived of which words, lines, thoughts go where on the page, and then why, so that then one can preserve the initiating gesture that might not fit one for one into the new parameters of that space, of that page, while maintaining what was underlying that motive and that choice. Inasmuch as those kinds of decisions and sometimes trade-offs have to be made in transitioning from a manuscript to a finished book, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to the process of having this thing on which you've spent who knows how many hundreds, thousands of hours out of your hands and in someone else's. Does it feel strange to have creative decisions or pragmatic decisions being made that might not be perfectly in keeping with your intention? And if so, how do you reconcile those?
Well, you know, I just thought this process was in such capable hands. Your hands. You did a great job. And I really didn't have any complaints throughout. You know, I really felt like it was very faithful to the way that I put it down, which was something that I worried about, you know, mm-hmm. because there are words all over the page and certain things that could really be misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. But even when I saw the first proof, I knew that it was working exactly how I wanted it to. And Stephanie was just so great about sort of composing that process. And so we did it a step at a time. The proofs looked great to me. You know, any suggestions I had were considered. So I feel very happy. And, you know, if anything, the decisions that were made, you know, about the cover, about the paper color, et cetera, I felt like they were great decisions that really enhanced the book aesthetically.
I'm so happy to hear it. I know all of us here were glad to have the chance to work with you on it. For those listening that are interested in hearing you read yet more, I know that you'll be at AWP in March in Portland. Are there any other events at which you'll be speaking that folks can catch you?
I will be reading at Innisfree in Boulder on April 9th. I will also be reading at Unnameable Books and at Connecticut College in the middle of April, I think the 14th and the 16th, respectively.
Fantastic. Well, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, Adam.
Thanks, guys.
As ever, thanks to Stephanie Geschwind, Editor-in-Chief at Colorado Review.
Thanks also to Arne Geschwind, composer of the wonderful music that you've heard throughout this podcast. This has been the March edition of the Colorado Review podcast.
This is Evan Senny.
And Daniel Schoening. Hope to see you again here in April.